Sometimes I will say something that makes the crowd feel good, and they show me they feel good by making this sound. Other times I piss them off.
You suck!
And they show me they're mad by making this sound. And other times they just sit there not doing anything. I don't know why this happens.
Screw you guys!
But I'm gonna figure out why.
Hello. Welcome to another episode of Why Didn't They Laugh, the podcast dedicated to one person's journey, myself, into the world of stand-up comedy. And 15 years deep, I'm now 15 years into this thing. My first set was opening for Kevin Hart in college. And from there, I've had a million experiences. And one thing that always plagues you as a comedian is that question, why didn't they laugh? And when you truly try and figure that out, you can't help but exposing yourself to pretty much every major discussion going on in your world. Why didn't they laugh? That question brings you down roads of everything from word count, semantics, you know, cutting the fat off a joke, the consonants of a joke, of a word, versus like gender equality, race, geography, like whether or not the sun is shining in the window, is the front row from France. It's just like, you never know. Like, do you have shit on your face? Like, are you yelling and you don't realize you're yelling? Is the speaker blown out in the back? You know, it's like, the more you try and figure that out, the more you're exposed to all these ideas. And today I want to give respect and love and life to a book that I am very close to. It's my mother wrote it. It's called Called to Healing, Reflections on the Power of Earth's Stories in Women's Lives by Jean Troy Smith. She wrote this when I was a little kid. And I'm going to read about 20 pages of it today. And then I'll read other sections and other podcasts. I just want to give you guys a taste. Just it's crazy to me that a book like this didn't get read by more people. And I now have a podcast. I think we're averaging between like 50 and 100,000 downloads a month now, which is awesome. And if I can get people to hear my mom's work, that'll be beneficial to everybody. Because she was talking about stuff 20 years before anyone else was. This was written in 1990, and you'll see that she brings up stuff that are now just being brought up and have already become annoying. Because she's when I think of a real, like a good feminist, that's my mom. There's a lot of, like, feminism has now gotten a pretty weird rap because they get very annoying and very alpha and very angry. My mom isn't like that. She was a very personal and profound story of her connecting to what it means to be a woman in modern America. Because a lot of women's voices have been silenced over the eons by patriarchy and infant and mother mortality rates at birth and male deities. You know, my mom talks in the book about how men could beat women, and women could beat children if they were allowed to by the man, and then a priest could emotionally beat the man. So it's just this hierarchy of beating. And she's not anti-male at all. Loves male. Male is great. But she doesn't want to be seen as a second-class citizen to a man. And I think women have already made this point pretty intensely in culture and have now started to excel past it until it's now just a very toxic environment. So it's important for me to read this today and show you a kinder, more authentic and possible path to female actualization. This is a woman whose dad was a coal miner. She was born during World War II in Wisconsin. Women weren't allowed to swim. And she's now a college professor and a mother of two and just very thoughtful. She has her garden. Everything in this book, she lives. She grows kale. She walks. She now has three dogs because, like, if anybody has to give up their dog for something, my mom will just be like, okay, I'll take the dog. She just does what she has to do. And people always write to me. Oh, and I'm also going to read a bunch of emails that you guys sent to me with responses. So thank you for all of those. And I just got back from Tampa. Next week, or no, my Friday episode, I'll analyze some stand-up clips. But today, let's listen to a little of my mom's book. And if you're not in the mood to listen to a book, you can always fast forward because I will be discussing more stuff after. But I'm telling you, listen to the book. It's phenomenal. Enjoy. Call to Healing by Jean Troy Smith, PhD. Part 1, The Stories Begin. Call to Healing was born from a basic human need to story personal experience. Humans have this need to story, but all of us do not organize our experiences into written form. Usually a focal event participates that organizing. For me, the event was a violent incident that involved one of my children. It was an event that caused me profound grieving. Grieving that in retrospect was necessary in order for me to see that I had been living most of my life uprooted from myself. It was an incident that gave me the impetus to find that self. In March of 1990, Owen was deliberately shot in the eye by a neighbor boy with a BB gun. In the end, my son did not lose his eye. He did not even lose any vision, a circumstance we were not to know for about 24 hours as we waited for surgery results. That act and its aftermath, however, marked the beginning of a journey for me that it would end with me writing this book. The event had begun as I left our house to pick up my older son, Jason, at his friend's house. It was 5 in the afternoon. Owen, I thought, was outside playing with friends. Jason called for me to come and pick him up. I told him that I would as soon as I could find Owen so that he could come with me. He was 9 years old. I'd never left him alone. As I left the house to find Owen, I met a force outside of my door that was so strong it pushed me backwards. I looked around. There was no wind. The air, in fact, was still. There was no one there. Nothing was under my feet that could have tripped me up. Instinctively, I thought, something has happened to Owen. I ran from the door and down the porch to find him. He wasn't out front or down the street. I rationalized that he had gone next door to play with the two boys who lived there. Again, I felt how still the air was, as before a storm. Living in Oswego for all these years has accustomed me to near constant air movement, calm and noisy, caressing and ferocious, because the city is situated on the southern shore of Lake Ontario. I stood on the sidewalk for a moment, then shook my head to dismiss the message. Something has happened to Owen. I came back to our house, got in the car, and drove to pick up Jason. I was gone 12 minutes. When I pulled into our driveway with Jason, my neighbor met me at the door. Jean, Owen's been hurt. He's at the hospital. Was he hit by a car, I asked? No, she replied. My mind started racing, trying to think of other possibilities. What happened, I asked. He's been shot, she said. I collapsed behind the steering wheel like a puppet whose strings the maker had abandoned. Shot, I said. Is he dead? No, he was shot in the eye. Who did it? Timmy. John is with him. In the 12 minutes I was gone, three things had happened. My husband had come home. 5 neighborhood boys who had witnessed the shooting had walked Owen home from around the corner and down the street where the incident had happened. And Owen and John had gone to the hospital 4 blocks from our house. As I heard the words, he's been shot, I knew that not only had Earth's nonverbal voice called to me as the force that had pushed me backwards as I walked out that door, but I ignored that voice, as I had been ignoring similar messages from Earth and self for decades. It was that insight that also caused me to momentarily collapse behind the wheel of the car that fateful day. Finally, I acknowledged the voice, and this time, I would choose not to ignore it. Two more such incidences happened shortly after that called to me to begin my journey to self. Anytime there's a hospitalization, however brief, that involves a gun, the hospital personnel are required to call the police to file a report. When a police officer took Owen's statement about the incident, one of the questions he asked was, "Where was your mother?" "She had gone to get my brother." "Then your mother was not at home?" "No, my mother was not at home." Until that day, I had never left Owen alone for 1 minute, let alone 12 of them. And now, written in the police report, was, "My mother was not at home." That I had gone to pick up my other son was not entered into the report. I asked, "Why not?" The officer replied, "That part was not pertinent to the case. Both John and I were with Owen when he gave his statement, but where was your father was never asked." That the report only noted the presence or absence of the mother from the home still causes some anger in me. Not only had I followed the cultural rules for being the good mother for all the minutes I had been a mother, except those critical 12, the choice to leave Owen and pick up Jason had been a Sophie's choice. I was forced to choose an either or. It may have taken me decades to finally heed Earth's call to healing, but once I did listen and then chose to continue listening, I acted on what I heard. In May, I heard about the Union Institute and its unique approach to doctoral studies, wrote for materials, and participated in the entry colloquium in October. My journey story had begun. The Union Institute approaches doctoral studies through a learner-centered, non-traditional way. I took advantage of that way and incorporated into my research not only the cultural and history of women back to pre-biblical times, but also the culture and history of my uprooted moorings. I came to understand that the self listens and learns differently from the way the self listens and learns. I came to understand that what the self hears is Earth's voice, heard through Earth's stories. This was the voice that called me to heal the wounds from decades of inner uprootedness. As I realized this insight and began to put my story on paper, I knew that I would need to use some words differently to describe what I was learning. Therefore, I've made some distinctions between identical words that carry different meanings. When I refer to self with a lowercase s, I mean the mundane, ordinary, routinely patterned, day-to-day self that operates as part of society. When I use self with an uppercase S, I mean the core that is each unique individual. When I use earth with a lowercase e, I refer to the dirt that is the ground that we walk on. When I use earth with the uppercase e, I mean the planet that in our vast universe is our home. Here's my story of how I wrestled with taking a path in life that I had no intention of ever taking. Never knew that it was possible to take. But once I saw that it was there to take, knew that if I did not, the wound created by that act on my son would never heal in me. I had a strong enough will to know that I did not want to go through the rest of my life with a sense of the uprooted and fragmented self that began to dominate my life. So even at the points in my journey where quitting the search would have been both easy and socially acceptable, I chose to push through the fear that can accompany one into the unknown. In my search to connect self to self, I read and listened to stories from women and a few men who have made similar journeys and came through those journeys having experienced new discoveries. For me, I knew that the path to wholeness would be found in stories, because stories in and of themselves hold healing properties. It is one of their attributes. It is in this personal appreciation for story then that I turned to the work that became the healing experience for me. Through this journey and the stories I heard and read, I have another way of evaluating and living life. I've not made radical changes in the external manifestations of who I am. Inwardly, however, self is rooting to self, and I, like the seed that sends roots down into the soil while simultaneously sending shoots up towards the sun, I'm growing wholly with a WH, That is the result of the choice I made in March of 1990 when Earth called to me, as it called to me many times in the past, but I chose not to hear. However, this time I chose to listen and to act. One story that I was drawn to early on in this journey to self is Magic in a World of Magic by Anne Cameron. In it, the young narrator tells a story concerning two important life questions that I asked myself after my world was turned upside down the day in March 1990. Who am I? And how did I come to be? This young narrator is invited to join a circle of older women telling stories. One of the older women is her grandmother. She is eager to please her grandmother, so she brought her grandmother gifts. I brought juice for her throat and food for her belly. But what did I bring for her spirit? Granny asked. A person can go days without water, weeks without food, but only hours without hope or love. And what did I have for her soul? For Granny, what nourishes her soul is a story. When the girl says she is not certain what to tell about, the grandmother charges her with, "Tell me how you came to be and who you are." In telling her story, the narrator goes back to long ago and far away, long before there were authorities, there were people. And these people lived in families, with the oldest mother as their wise one, and everything belonged to the women, and all women were mother to all children. Vicki L. Sears writes a story called Stick Talk, in which her narrator learns from a medicine stick who she is and how she came to be. Medicine Stick tells the women who found her, "I'm a root, once ground grown and anchored into the earth as you are, always." The sticks reminds her, "I'm also a water floater and I'm a maker of fire." In other words, this root of and from the earth represents the elements of earth, lives complementary to water, and is known to give her life to fire and be transformed, as is she who is the listener of Stick's story. "Listen in yourself to the old parts. They're still good," says Stick. Each day since finding Stick, the narrator touches her in leaving or coming, and she thanks the Hall of Grandmothers and the Creator for placing Stick in her path. The listener in this story who finds Stick lying on the ground is in need of a story to nourish her spirit. She is in a phase of her life where she feels eternally lonely and disconnected from life, uprooted. Knowing that her soul needs to be fed, Stick nourishes her with the story of how she came to be and who she is. Another question I found myself asking as I read and listened to stories is, what truths are they telling me? They refer to the stories, the storytellers, and the characters in the stories. To find answers to this question, I took the words story and truth, place them on a metaphorical turnstile so that I could look at the different facets of these words in order to see in the turning what the facets told me about the they. The stories I've listened to and read that make sense to me on this journey have their roots in ancient times. There are stories whose roots go deep into goddess consciousness, course through thousands of years of our planet's historical veins, and send up shoots in today's writings about nature. They begin with sentences like, "When the world was new and young, did Mama sing every day? Nature has been for me, for as long as I can remember, a source of solace, inspiration, adventure, and delight, a home, a teacher, a companion." Preserved in a cave sanctuary for over 20,000 years, a female figure speaks to us about the minds of our early Western ancestors. Or, "I was born in the city of Voodoo, New Orleans, Louisiana." Or, "Long before there was an earth and long before there were people called human, there was a sky world." Or, "Together with a few human beings, dead and living, and their achievements, trees are what I most love and revere." They're the stories of Demeter, Sarah, Lorraine, Inanna, Louisa, Beth, Hildegard, and Terry. There's something in these stories that I hear and say, "I know that story. That is my story too." They are stories that tell me that being born female did not condemn me to a belief that, therefore, I am profane, unclean, put on this earth only to continue to release evil and pain in the world when I release new life through birth. There are stories that proclaim that the female is sacred. I present my discoveries in part two called Storytelling and Truth Telling, I Remember and I Recall. In part three, I present an eco-feminist reader response analysis of four fictional narratives. The narratives I've chosen are Cactus Thorn by Mary Austin, The Dollmaker by Harriet Arnau, The Fires of Bride by Ellen Galford, and Send My Roots Rain by Ibis Gomez Vega. The women who authored these narratives create women characters whose lives are formed and transformed by the relationship to the earth. At certain junctures in their life, the women characters are uprooted from earth and from the core of the self. A woman so uprooted is alienated, fractured, not whole. Unless that woman finds a way to root, she cannot heal to wholeness. I look closely at the journey of these women characters during their experiences of being uprooted and examine if and or how they reroot themselves. Part four examines the complex meanings of sacred space as my journey continues. I discovered that I had a need to find an inviolate place where I could feel safe to ask the questions that would require me to be courageous on finding the answers, or if I could not find the answers, at least have the opportunity to delve as deeply into the questions as I needed to delve. The everyday world became both frightening and inauthentic for me because the questions I was asking were not the kind to be probed between folding loads of laundry and picking kids up from school. I needed space that provided me with uninterrupted time that I controlled. The women in the stories that I was drawn to and the women who told the stories I discovered had the same need. Thus, I drew solace and instruction from their journey's lessons, and I write these reflections in part four. I suggest that sacred space, finding it and naming it, is necessary for uprooted women to root themselves with earth in order to begin the process of healing themselves and their beings. I found the process of rooting also heals the earth. The same earth that helps these women to be healed and nourished on their life's journey. It was my most joyous discovery, the ongoing interwoven relationship between earth and self, and that discovery and the writing of it that rerouted myself to self. I gained my perspective that I had been actively seeking since that fateful day in March of 1990. Mircea Eliade suggested a journey into the sacred in the 1950s. He argued that all nature is capable of revealing itself as a cosmic sacralate. Acknowledging the presence of alienating, profane space, he believes that, properly speaking, there is no longer any world. There are only fragments of a shattered universe, an amorphous mass consisting of an infinite number of more or less neutral places in which men and women move and are governed and driven by the obligations of the existence incorporated into an industrial society. The experience of sacred space, says Eliade, makes a meaningful life possible. I found that the manifestation of sacred in space creates the center of oneself. This human life can only be lived in sacred places. Because it is only in those sacred places that people participate fully in their being. To prepare myself for this research, I sought out life stories that have nurtured and enlightened me on my own particular life's journey. Which stories have I needed to know to move me along my journey, I asked myself. I found that a story appealed to me if, when I interacted with it, I saw another facet of where I came from, who I am, and how I can cope with the world, culture, tells me is true. Often, what the world tells me is true is in contradiction to what Earth tells me is true. The resonance of such an interaction taught me how I became to be, who I am, and what, in fact, are my life's truth. A woman's journey, however, has never been as visible or as valued as a man's journey. There is ample history supporting this position. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, for example, the men wrote the laws and held the quote-unquote truth. These laws live on through the pages of the Bible, where a religious hierarchy exists with a single male deity at the pinnacle. Women were subsumed into this generic he and told that he included she, but she did not include he. Even though Genesis 1:27 says that God created man in his image, in the divine image, he created him, male and female, he created them. Females have been denied visibility and value. Like the declaration, I can't say certain L words, like the Declaration of Independence that espouses, all men are created equal. White women and people of color, that's a big difference. Well, women and people of color were excluded from the generic men, that men meant men, white men, particularly with white men with property. Nicole Bessard laments this cultural invisibility and marginalization of women. She tells readers that because the dominant language users have attempted to erase the female, it is important that each woman tells her story. She says that even though it is getting late, each woman must repeat her story at least once in her life with passion and with hope as a kind of inscription. This is an imperative for each woman because not only is the reality of woman not the reality of men, but because women have been written out of history. Each woman writing her story will show the desire to assert herself in language by actualizing with its help a manner of being, a manner of seeing, and a manner of thinking. Because where there is masculine, one sees no feminine. Bassard goes on to say that to render the woman visible is a writing task which necessitates shifts in meanings as yet unedited in the imaginary realm of language. A woman telling her story finds her own truth outside of her relation to the male is not a new idea. It is as old as Inanna. Isis, Astarte, Hathor, and Sky Woman. I don't know any of those things. It is as old as the tale of Mother Earth is old. And why women need the goddess, my mom is too fucking smart. And why women need the goddess, psychological and political reflections. Carol Christ acknowledges the truth of women. She writes that, the simplest and most basic meaning of the symbol of the goddess is the acknowledgement of the legitimacy of female power as a beneficent and independent power, that women will no longer look to men or male figures as saviors. In fact, women need not look at female figures as saviors either, because women do not need to be saved. The divine principle, the sustaining power, is in herself. Women then can choose to worship no male deity again. We are whole, self-sufficient, meaning-centered, and sacred. However, women need not burn all bridges, forging individual paths with neither support from those around us nor ancestral memory of those who went before us. Whether we can acknowledge and rejoice in the fact that certain images of the goddess and what they represent are reflections of what is in all of us women. That image can be in the Buffalo Woman of the Plains Indians, Kali, a goddess of India, the African goddess Oshun of the ancient Yoruba tribe, or the powerful Celtic triple goddess called Bride or Bridget. To acknowledge them is to acknowledge that it is the earth that is life giver, that her treasures feed, clothe, and sustain us while we live, and that when we die, she accepts us back into her. Some of the stories that I present are informed by the writings of women scholars who have personally journeyed to sacred sites of goddess centers in such diverse places as Sumer, Ireland, Greece, India, Hungary, Merlin Stone, yada yada. Some of these writers have experienced the life of a woman-centered culture, longed for by Nicole Brossard sometime in their growing up years. Paul Gunn, Alice Walker. There are a few who know that experience of a woman-centered culture, usually but not always, from the culture of their family. Living that life led them to uncover the truths of their existence as women with their own histories in their respective cultures and in their respective times. I've never been to the sites designated as goddess sites, where anthropologists and historians have uncovered caves and labyrinths and passages that hold artifacts pointing to a goddess culture existing for thousands of years before the patriarchy. I have, however, participated in a culture where the female energy of my mother's mother, a midwife, and of my mother and her six sisters, nurtured and centered my growing up energy in a time of strong patriarchal dominance. World War II, the post-war period, and the Eisenhower years. The knowing and the energy, hidden, lying dormant in me for over four decades, came alive and gave me the desire to research more about my half of the species and its history when I read The Chalice and the Blade by Rhian Eisler in 1987. My worldview changed dramatically when I finished reading this book. Though there had been other books written on goddesses before Ms. Eisler's, I had found no reference to them. Ms. Eisler's book marked a crossroads for me. In the past, when I had asked the question, where did I come from? The answer I was given was, from God, with emphasis on God as He. Reading this book made me realize that the vague feeling of uprootedness that had been with me from childhood, I never quite belonged anywhere, came because no one had ever answered my question, where did I come from, in a satisfactory way. I knew that I had not come from anyone I had read about in the Bible, and until Ms. Eisler's text, I did not know that there was a pre-Bible tradition of the goddess, my source of being, the tradition from whence I came. Learning not only when God was a woman, but that God was a woman, I came to realize that if I had been lied to about where I came from, so had countless others. Reading Rhian Eisler's book started me researching whatever I could find on the topic of pre-biblical spirituality. The more I read, the more I became aware that not only had I been lied to, but that the lie about coming from a male God precipitated other lies being told as truths. Males are superior to and hold property and sexual rights over females. And males, being God's image on earth, have dominion over all other earth creatures, from wolves to redwoods to females. Thus, males have been given a right to conquer and plunder prairies, rainforests, and the sea's fish population in the name of progress and profit and development. Childhood memories of physical abuse started to come forth in me. Those senseless acts of being hit for no reason started to make sense. If there can be sense found in senseless acts of violence, adult males could treat women and children in any way they found suitable because of the truths held by the culture, in particular, the community where I grew up. Man could hit me for my own good, and I was to be grateful. That man could be father, uncle, even neighbor. After all, as male, he held the God-given power to discipline me so that when I grew up and married, I would know my place, be a God-fearing woman. I would have been trained right. Right, meaning that I would grow up to be the silenced woman, and I had been reared to be the silenced girl. It was said of me, she's such a good girl, so quiet, she obeys so well. Yes, I hoped that to obey would mean that I would not be hit anymore. That was a false hope, because I was hit for more than having transgressed a rule. I was hit at random. In my childhood, there was another interesting pecking order. Men could hit women and children, but women and children could not hit men. However, women could hit children if the men gave their permission to do so. Thus, the men were placed in the position of being God's judge and jury on earth. Ironically, there was someone who had power over even the men, and that was the local priest. He held the power to condemn any and all of us to hell for all of eternity. He told us that he had the power and that we were condemned. From this perspective of male superiority and dominance, physical abuse was condoned and practiced in my family, my community, and my church. The second book that had a dramatic effect on me was the one that was published in April 1991 called Sisters of the Earth, Women's Prose and Poetry About Nature by Lorraine Anderson. What Ms. Anderson wrote about in Sisters of the Earth answered a question nagging me for years, a question that I could not find any information and collected research on. Where were the women role models to whom nature mattered as much as, but not in the same way that I mattered to the men, from whom I would know? Who am I? Where were the female Aldo Leopolds, the John Murrs, the Henry David Thoreaus? Indeed, where was Thoreau's mother? She was my metaphor. I would ask people in a rhetorical manner, and what of Henry's mother? Did she too write about ants or wilderness or war? And we do not have her papers? Did she write some of the works credited to her son? Was her perspective the same as it different from her sons and aunts on, or wilderness or war? Yes, I had Willa Cather and Rachel Carson and of late Annie Dillard as role models, but I knew deep down from my growing up years in farm country near Aldo Leopold's home and from participating in human interactions with the earth that there were more than three women who were up to the task of writing their experiences with and their participation of the earth. My interaction with the earth, namely the woods in back of our house, the fields at the bottom of our hill, and the immense gardens, were my source for consolation and solace in my childhood. I had not written about these interactions, but I had them and I remembered them. The reason I could not find the information I sought was that it was scattered. It had never been collected until Lorraine Anderson undertook the task. Indeed, there are such women. In fact, there are so many tasks that Ms. Anderson found that she needed to limit her collection. She chose to include only women in the United States, and then she had to limit those choices. In the four fictional narratives that comprise part three of this book, I follow the theory put forth by Elizabeth A. Flynn in her essay, Gender and Reading, which espouses a feminist reader response criticism. Self and other reader and text, she writes, interact in such a way that the reader learns from the experience without losing critical distance. Reader and text interact with a degree of mutuality. Self and other remain distant and so create a kind of dialogue. Reader response criticism holds that the reader plays a vitally important role in shaping the literary experience. Reader response critics, then, are ones who share the conviction that readers of texts play as important a role in interpreting these texts as the writers who wrote the texts and the narrators within the texts who tell the story. Reader response criticism is a critical method that assesses what exists between the reader and the text, not what ought to be or what is good. Its purpose is to describe, not evaluate. Wow, that's awesome. There are clear advantages to using reader response criticism. First of all, such a method acknowledges that active engagement of both the writer and the reader. It emphasizes the reader's comprehending a text by mediating the symbolic knowledge and experience expressed in the text with the knowledge and experience existing in the mind and the heart of the reader. Such an interaction acknowledges the literary contributions of both text and reader, and therefore provides a voice for the text and a framework for the construction of the meaning of the text. Thus, the meaning of a text depends on the interaction of the reader, the writer, and the interpretive strategies employed. What a reader gets out of the text depends on what the reader brings to the text. Second, a reader response criticism confronts the common ground taken up by both the experiences suggested in the text and the real experiences of the reader, between the reading self and the other text. If the reader integrates past experiences with the experiences created by the text, then the gender and philosophy of the reader are important. Flynn discovers this importance when, in the spring of 1980, she and two male colleagues team up and taught a class of first-year composition with 52 students, 26 women and 26 men. The students were to respond to three short stories chosen by the three professors. The students' responses were the data for research in gender and reading. The results of the data provided the seed for Flynn's conclusion that the gender of the reader plays a significant role in reader response criticism. All right, that's the problem of assessing the impact of a reader's gender and philosophy on the perception of a literary text reflects what Elizabeth Minich calls a root problem. She writes the problem in that a few privileged men define themselves as constituting mankind, humankind, and simultaneously saw themselves as to akin to what mankind, humankind ought to be in fundamental ways that distinguish themselves from all others. Thus, at the time, they removed women and non-privileged men within their culture and other cultures from mankind. They justified that exclusion on the grounds that the excluded were by nature and culture lesser people. The women writers whose works I've chosen to consider are quote-unquote lesser people, as are the characters whom they develop. She's being sarcastic. My interpretation of the fictional narratives in part three will be informed by my gender, my philosophy, and my life experiences. A feminist reader response reading of the text, woven together with personal experience, conversations with friends and colleagues, and library research, provides the basis for my interpretation. This is a book, then, about several women, real and fictive, fictitious, on their journey into both sacred and profane spaces as they remember and recall the truths that tell them how they came to be and who they are. Some break through to discovery, some do not. Those who do not learn that it is Earth's stories that root the self to self and connect them with all that lives. It is Earth that tells them how they came to be and who they are. That was part one, and I wouldn't mind giving a little reader, response. That's me, the big guy. I don't know if you guys realize this, but this is before the Da Vinci Code was written, and all these other. This is before Whole Foods and the Bravo Channel. I just can't believe how far ahead my mom was in 1990. She wrote this in 1991. And at the time, it was bonkers to people. And granted, listen, I understand, she's a college professor, so sometimes the words can be a little daunting. You can see me struggling with them, and I'm a fairly intelligent person. But the heart of this text is so incredible to me because she has that view of women and men that I subscribe to, that it's not like the new 2016 feminism is just so ridiculous compared to the thoughtful, intrinsic feminism that my mother, is writing about. It's not about an external conquest where you have to dominate a man to feel powerful or you have to be the CEO of a company. All that is possible and fine if that's what naturally happens, but it's the inward looking to the self, that journey, that personal journey, which is where the beauty and the equality and the doability comes from. Any external motivations, external victories, it always ends in hypocrisy. You always see these people end up making hypocrites out of themselves. And yeah, like the Da Vinci Code, I remember reading that and it was so good, but the whole thing was that there were women in texts before Constantine and the Romans like got rid of them. And what is the role of Jesus's mother and Mary? But my mom was saying this shit. And I'm not trying to like get her credit for this. I know I sound like I'm Don King or something. Like, she's the best fighter in the world. No, it's just like, I can't believe how far culture lagged on this topic. And then now has perverted itself into just this ego Olympics that we all see. Rather, in so many quote unquote minority groups, it isn't the self journey. It isn't like she talks about privileged people in this, and that's the way I feel they should be talked about. Not this new, like, if you have white skin, you're privileged. Why don't you go door to door in a trailer park and tell everyone how privileged they are? Now, her point is that the people in power are white males with privilege, and that they even had to look to the next level of power, which was the priest, and that it was this hypocritical waterfall of power, and that women had their power taken from them. And you can almost see why in some ways. Like when I'm reading this book, especially out loud, because when I'm reading in my mind, I can just skim over stuff. Look at how much she references other people and gives credit and talks about her influences. Women, naturally, I believe, are very social bond driven. Like there's so little ego in this book. She's like, I read this book and it changed my life, and I read this book and that's why I feel this way. I would argue that it's a lot more common that if a man was writing this book, they would be presenting all these ideas as their own. And they would probably get more credit, and they would probably get more fame and more money, because it's like, oh, wow, did you see what Daniel Brown came up with on his own? Whereas I think a lot of women would write and describe the community that was formed in their quest. And I can see that in my mom's book in every page. It's almost, I wouldn't call it annoying, but it's like, just take the credit, mom. Just talk about your thoughts. But that's not her instincts. Her instincts are, when I read The Chalice and the Blade, it changed my life because of this, this, this. And that's why I got to this next point. And it was because of this story and this tradition and this person's mother. This is not a self-promotional thing. And I wrestle with self-promotion. And I just don't think that she battles that demon. So it's very nice to see. And I think that that's one reason why women have been dominated over the millennia, is because they're nicer. Now, I don't know if the word's nicer, but just like, they see the big picture of the community a lot better than men do in general, where they're like, well, if I cause a scene right now, we'll all lose in the long run, because then we won't be allowed in this restaurant anymore. And I know how much my children like this restaurant. That's how a woman thinks a lot of times. And then it's at their own detriment. It's at the benefit of the group, but the detriment personally. Men usually think like, I'm going to make a scene because I'm a man, and I will just do this and I'll take what I deserve. And I'm not saying men are evil. In fact, men are awesome. It's just a short-term versus long-term thought. It's carbohydrates versus fat. You know, women have a much more evolved concept of the slow burn, the long-term. Let's make it through 30 winters, not just this meal. Okay, I'll read a little more. Part two. Storytelling and truth-telling. I remember and I recall. What happened? Asked the mother of her child when he comes to her crying. He is 3 years old and he was playing with a friend. He tells his story. What happened? We ask of poets and philosophers and scientists when we want to know how the world began. They tell us in their poetry, essays, and tracts. What happened? People asked Rachel Carson when the eagles were dying, their eggs cracking before the embryos could form to live life beyond the shell. She tells us in the story in Silent Spring. The telling of stories goes back before the dawn of recorded time. We know that because the dawn of recorded time begins with the writing down of the stories, and that had been told in the oral tradition for millennia. Merlin Stone writes that there is documentation from about the year 2400 BC, literature and surviving artifacts on the invasion of the northern people. There is suggestive evidence that there were earlier invasions dating back to 4000 BC, before the time of written records. What is important about these invasions is that the northern Indo-European and Indo-Aryan tribes that invaded the southern tribes of the Mediterranean brought with them male deities and an attitude that they were a superior people based on their ability to conquer and more culturally developed goddess-centered peoples. In their conquering over the centuries, they replaced the goddesses with a supreme male deity by severely punishing those who did not worship the male deity. One method of forcing the change was to write down their stories infused by that values and beliefs, thus usurping and, for thousands of years, suppressing any memory of goddess spirituality. Stone quotes theologian Sheila Collins, who believes that theology is ultimately political, that determining categories of what is good and what is evil, of how human communities deify the transcendent, has more to do with the power dynamics of the social system, which create the theologies, than with the spontaneous revelation of truth from another quarter. Wow. Quick narrator's note. That is very interesting. That it's almost like a lot of religions in these giant institutions form to in response to just wanting power. Okay, back to the book. Truth told through spontaneous revelation then is not what will necessarily prevail. Theologies created to justify a conquering point of view are theologies not created from spontaneous revelations of truth. Therefore, the remembering and the recalling of the conquering tribes that forced their beliefs in male deities may be based on false constructs. One of those false constructs is illuminated by Mary Condron in a section of her book, The Serpent and the Goddess, that she calls the myth of objectivity. In that section, she writes, "Most writers assume that they are objective and therefore can arrive at truth. Feminist scholars, among others, increasingly recognize the need to change this approach. The myth of objectivity serves to conceal the fact that the male mind has become sacred and is allowed to experiment regardless of the social, human, or ecological consequences." In her introduction, The Creation of Patriarchy, Gerda Lerner adds another layer to the need to remember and retell the goddess tale by saying, "The existence of women's history has been obscured and neglected by patriarchal thought, in fact, which has significantly affected the psychology of men and women. These facts that Stone and Condrad and Lerner uncover about Earth's historical past have also obscured truth in the telling of both women's and men's stories." Wow. As the Native American poets found hard evidence that their ancestors left written records in the United States back to 1772, so too have feminist historians discovered written evidence that at one time women were not subservient. Thus, women need not invent anymore. We can, in truth, remember without the need to invent, that we walked alone, full of laughter, bathed, bare-bellied. Story, according to Jane Yolen, is what affirms humans in their humanity. Not the development of the thumb or the ability to laugh. Hey, whoa, laughter's important, damn it. I'm just kidding. Stories. They remind us of our past. They force us to the future. Marilyn Sanders Mobley talks of story in familiar fashion to Yolen. She writes, "Story not only teaches us to value our ancestors, but the value of nomo, the power of the world, to help us name ourselves and shape our lives in the tradition of our ancestors." According to Gabriel Lucer Rico, the need to tell stories, or in the verb form, to story, is fundamental to intellectual development. "We have," says Rico, "an innate drive to create wholeness out of our many-fold experience in the form of stories and to express that wholeness to others." As cited by Rico, Renee Fuller describes that this drive occurs at a formative stage of intellectual development, and it occurs in all cultures. Through storytelling, we build our sense of who we are, what is significant of our worldview. Through storytelling, we make mental connections, perceive patterns, create relationships among people, things, feelings, and events, and we carry with these drives a need to express these perceived connections to others. Storytelling gives voice to and articulates what has been silenced, repressed, and excluded in the lives of people of the tribes when the stories that were written down by their oppressors became law. When those laws excluded the way of life of the silenced tribes, the impact was sometimes devastating. The most obvious example is the first of the Ten Commandments. "I am the Lord thy God. Thou shalt not have strange gods before me." Thus, the exclusion of the goddess in all of her forms and spirituality became outlawed, and any people who were caught performing ceremonies honoring her were punished. Paula Gunn Allen notes that for Native American, story was as an important part of ritual and ceremony. What is story? I call on David Lemming's definition because it describes precisely the role that story played in my journey. He defines story as the narrating of a sequence of events that helps the reader and the listener search for identity in the context of the universal struggle between order and chaos. That's a good definition. Search for identity in the context of the universal struggle between order and chaos. Batman and the Joker. That was my addition. Storytelling answers for me who I am and how I came to be, and places me in the vast constructs of the cosmos. Thus, when I talk of telling stories, the need to tell them and the need to hear them or read them, I feel that I am touching the absolute core of human existence, the center of all that I hold sacred as well as profane, the matrix of all that is living and has lived, of life's energy itself. When I tell or listen to stories, I am immersing myself in the most profound of all intertextualities, the web of life. Whatever we do to the web, we do to ourselves. Finding Leeming's definition of story gave me a context for my affinity to the narrative. Okay, I'll take a breather at that point. Yeah, I think that's one problem facing our culture now is our lack of identity through stories and ancestral honoring and culture. I think so many people lied and were so greedy and so terrible that we're now losing trust in the government and the banks and the school systems and the cops. You know, this country is now at a place where we're trying to redefine ourselves as individuals and not as part of the group, because the group seems so insane. And I think this type of thinking can be very helpful to a lot of different people, men included. The more you read this book, or the more I will read this on my podcast, you'll see that this is a woman's story, and it's focused on the silencing of women, but at no point is she excluding this journey should be taken by men as well, and that it's a similar journey. It's just, I think she's highlighting women because they've been so excluded for so many years. And it's pretty obvious why the male deity is more valuable in capitalism. Because men with our crazy balls full of crazy jizz want to conquer and take over things. Sometimes just for the hell of it, just for the rage of it, just for the possible sex of it. And that vibe, for lack of a better word, is way more conducive to Madison Avenue. It's way more conducive to Wall Street. It's way more conducive to our government. That it's justified when you're worshiping something that innately conquers and destroys and hoards. It's got to be a man. And that one thing I liked about that story definition is the balance between what was the exact line? It was chaos and order. It's the yin yang. It's the male female. You got to have that combination. See, I don't think that our deity should be just a woman. I don't think it should be. I think it goes beyond gender, and I think that we're very limited by our perceptions of the world based on our own biology. I mean, it's the creator destructor is God. It's both. It's the woman and the man. It's the destroyer and the creator at the same exact moment. It's a singularity. And losing that concept of where your root is, what holds you to this world? That's important to keep that in mind. Because you see it everywhere. I mean, the Oscars, it was race, 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 movie, race, movie, race, race issue, movie, movie, race, race, rape, race, rape, rape, rape. It's like, I get it. I get it that global warming's an issue. I get that there's race issues and all that. But it's literally, it's a goddamn award show for movies. That's what it is. And the problem I have with Black people right now is, who cares? And it's easy to say, oh, as a white man, you can just say that. No, take a page out of Rembrandt, Monet, and those dudes in France. There is this very established bullshit authority of art called the Salon, very similar to the concept of the Academy. Prestigious, you know, old, ignorant. And don't just think that the only ignorances in the world are Black, white, or whatever you think is the current thing isn't universal. There's always going to be a group of older people who were raised in a different time and have a different thought process. So when you're dealing with old power, old money, and very ingrained traditions based on power, a power structure, you're going to have a rift between the chaotic artists and the ordered establishment. So what did Rembrandt and Monet and those dudes do? They started their own. And they became so successful that their first showing, which I think was like in an attic, or it might have been like a furniture store. It's some like funny location. The art today would be worth $2 billion. So I always wonder, unless your rights are being taken from you, like you're not allowed to make movies, you're not allowed to be in this room. Those are things that you protest. But if there's just this snobbery, the we don't like your kind around here look with the big smile and the liberal donation to Obama, if that's really what you're feeling, then screw them. Then bail. Why seek the approval of people that will never approve of you? Everybody goes through that. Everybody has that feeling at times when it's like when you're at a place and you're like, I was like that with alt comics. I used to always feel like I wanted to impress them and then I'd be angry at them. And, you know, I'd rant on a podcast about alt people and how much I hated them, even though I secretly wanted their approval. And I didn't know why they didn't see that I was a good comic and I was intelligent and, you know. And then it just hit me. I'm like, I don't even want to be around these people. Like, why do I want to be around a bunch of comics that headline in a hooded sweatshirt and read notes of jokes that they've had for 10 years? Like, that's who I'm seeking the approval of. People that act like they don't, like not trying is cool, but yet they try harder than anyone in the world. And they usually use their parents' money to like promote on YouTube. Like, those are the people I'm trying to get the approval of. It's like, no. And then as soon as I let that go, it was this wave of peace came over me. Probably short-lived. I'm a bit of a war monkey, so I sought other war. But that was that. And I feel that way about the a lot of this race, gender stuff that's going on. I think the only real issue Black people can complain about is police brutality. That's an issue. That is an absolute issue. There's laws in the books that are very racist, and cops are an occupying force in a lot of neighborhoods that are very, very Black. But all this like diversity at the Oscars shit. I mean, what my friend Steve Byrne did a post about, yeah, diversity means Black. It doesn't. What about Asians? Because he's Asian. What about Indians? What about people from Sri Lanka? There's nobody from Bulgaria was nominated. What about the Kazakhstan people or the Moors? What about, you realize that when you're on a group or a council that's looking for diversity and someone's like, oh, an African. And they're like, oh, cool. And it's like, no, but an African American. It's like, why? African is a more diverse point of view. Like someone from Africa, like a Black guy from Africa is a lot more diverse than a Black dude from Brentwood. Because if you're truly not racist and you know that skin is just basically like SPF lotion, like that's what it is. Black skin is SPF. That's all it is. Now, there's a very strong culture that's very important and needs to be honored and supported and all that stuff. But like race is an illusion. And people that keep wanting to quote unquote diversify by taking people of the same economic and social backgrounds, but who happen to have different amounts of pigment in their skin, are out of their minds. That's a sickness. So when dealing with stuff like Jada Pinkett Smith, I mean, Chris Rock was so funny when he was talking about, well, Will Smith got paid $20 million to do Wild Wild West, so he can pump the brakes. Like, you know, it's not sexist to ask women what they're wearing because men all wear the same tuxedo. Like if we had a swan feather sticking out of her ass, they'd be like, what are you wearing, Chris? The touchiness of our culture is getting to critical mass where it's exhausting. Everyone's exhausted by it. No one, like you used to be able to talk politics. You could talk issues. Now everyone's like, I can't talk about that. I'll get too angry. And it's like, okay, we better start connecting the earth and the capital self and the capital earth pretty quick, or we're about to just start floating into the nebula of just rage and fear and self-hatred, because that's what that is. You know, and people's obsession with Donald Trump is because he's representing our own detachment from ourselves. He's just this absolute moron. Moron, guys. Moron who'd be terrible with public speech or free speech. That's all I care. My major concern is, can someone be sued for a joke? Donald Trump would sue a comedian, no question. If he could make an executive order against comedy, you don't think he'd do that? You don't think he'd just start suing comedians? Like, how can any libertarian type person And I know a lot, I know some libertarians and some like personal rights people that are all about Trump. You guys are the ones who should be the most against Trump, because him speaking his mind is he's just speaking his own mind. He doesn't care about your mind, and he'll destroy it. He'll take your freedom from you. And don't think he won't. And I just have to say stuff like that every now and then because it's getting too real. I mean, he literally could become our president, and we'd have a major problem. You think George W. was bad? Not even close. At least he was from like an old political family, and he knew how to like follow the rules. Trump is insane. Okay, that being said, let's read a couple emails. Okay, this one's pretty cool. It's from Dylan, and he sent me a picture of a notebook that he wrote physically wrote the message to me on. He said, "Hey, Owen, I've been a huge fan for years now, and I love the podcast. You were so goddamn funny at the Hollywood Improv on Wednesday. I've been a shitty open micer for a few years now and was wondering if you had any advice about trusting yourself over the audience when it comes to a joke you think is really funny. Is there a three strikes you're out rule? Thank you so much for the laughs and for even reading this, Dylan." Okay, Dylan, what's up? That's a great question. I mean, that's kind of like that balance between order and chaos. It's like you got it. That I don't know how to put that into words, because there is moments you do have to listen to the audience, because in the end of the day, you got to make them laugh, or else you should get into slam poetry, because those people don't care what the audience do. They can just ramble. But we are laugh makers. But also, you don't want to like take their guidance, because then everything would just flatline and become just a bland algorithm. You know, a lot of companies do that. They do too many focus groups, and they're like, "It turns out little kids all like orange." And then they make Pepsi orange. I don't know. I don't know. That doesn't make any sense. But just, it's almost like sexual. It's like, you got to kind of do your own thing, but still like vibe off them. Because no one wants anyone who's just only into pleasing, where it's just like, whatever you want, I'll do. But you also don't want someone who's tapped out and is just doing, like, just trying to come as fast as possible. So it's that balance of like, this is who I am sexually. I'm not going to change that, but I'll listen to what you are too, and we'll find something together. And that's the relationship comedians have with the audience. It's like, this is what I find funny, and I won't compromise, but I will shape it with what you need. And a lot of it is just the demographics of the audience, how long your set is, how much you're being paid. I know that sounds silly, but that's a factor. If you're being paid a lot by a corporation, it's like, it's not about the money. It's about what the money represents, which is like, you're here for us now. You know, if you're getting paid 10 bucks from the improv or zero, which is, I've done 1,000 shows making $0. That's when you're truly free to explore, because if they don't laugh, it's okay. Cause it wasn't unprofessional. You're not getting paid. But if you're getting paid a ton of cash, you better, you know, Derek Jeter that ball. Like you have to make them laugh. So that's my answer to that. Let's find another email. Okay, here's another. Hi, Owen. It's from Nikki. "I'm in need of some advice, and you seem like the kind of guy willing to help. I've always wanted to be a writer. It's the only time that I truly feel comfortable. I hate to talk, but I love the sound of dialogue. I can write pages and pages of it, but when faced with a social situation, I'd rather sit in silence. It's better than getting stuck in a conversation about the weather. I live in Scotland. It's always raining. The book, The Like Switch, that you recommended on Why Didn't They Laugh, helped me out a lot with a script I was writing recently about an M16 idea man. So thanks for that." Or MI6. Yeah, that's different than M16. See, that was my culture. Adding that I looked like a 16, which is a machine gun in America, and a group of, yeah, I get it. "Listening to the podcast has made me want to try something new. I tend to gravitate towards writing drama and wanted to take on the challenges of writing a comedy. My idea was an animated series called Blasphemy, which would follow the early life of Jesus' life. I've written the pilot episode, which deals with the true events that lead to the birth of Jesus. Here's where I need your help. Would you be able to give me some advice on improving my script? Yeah. All right. I need someone to tell me truthfully what works and what doesn't. Let me know if you can help, and I'll send the script over. Absolutely. Hang on. Let me just write and say definitely. Definitely. Def, send script. I'd love to. Okay. On another note, your argument with Piers Morgan made my night. Okay. Yeah, that's cool. I'd love to check out your script. That sounds fascinating. There's this book, this funny story about Jesus as like, he's in his 20s. I read it. It was pretty funny. What was that called? Lamb? Something like that. But yeah, no, that's see, the Jesus story, I don't feel is that dicey. I don't think you're going to run into too many problems with that. As long as you don't like call Christians dumb or like make any negative statements, you can do satire and mockery and no one cares. Okay, this is from Angela. Dear Owen Benjamin, hey, first congrats to Amy and the little baby who probably won't be little, but I'm sure an adorable infant. Thank you. I don't write celebrities or cool people often, maybe a tweet here or there, so I kind of feel lame. But anyway, you probably heard a lot, but I want to thank you for your podcast, Straight Up Badass. I've been depressed, which I've never been before, and haven't really known how to shake it. I really love your podcast and comedy and life lessons and songs and guests and surely your joking and book recommendations and hydration recommendations. I really do make hydration recommendations. It's all really kick-ass, man. Comedy is something I've always been passionate about because it's the only thing that truly makes me feel better, and laughter is the universal language of the world. Wow, okay, I said it. I'm lame. I wish I could do stand-up, but my comedy is unfortunately limited to punchlines only people under 7 years old will appreciate, and punchlines followed by finger guns and side-eye winks. Can't wait to see you live for the first time when you're back in New York. Shots. Great. Thank you for that. That's very sweet of you, Angela. I appreciate that. And by the way, if you can write jokes that make seven-year-olds laugh, you can do stand-up. I mean, Mitch Hedberg is one of my all-time favorite comedians. And one thing that makes him so wonderful is his innocence. You know, it's like, I'm addicted to gambling. I have to go to a Gamblers Anonymous. I'm not addicted to gambling. I'm addicted to sitting in semicircles. Like, that's great. And yeah, I get you. A lot of people are depressed right now, Angela. Don't feel alone on that thing. A lot of people have this weird detachment that's happening. They feel detached. I feel like they're the culture in life isn't giving us on a monkey level, on our primate level, a lot of the needs that we require. And I think a lot of people thought that money and success would fill in for grandmothers, you know, and it just doesn't. And grandfathers and dinner time and playing Scrabble. We miss eye contact. Vladimir says, hey, Owen, just wanted to give you a feedback on what makes me happy. My daughter skipping is the greatest, makes me so happy and makes me want to be a kid again. Cheers, Vlad. That is awesome. See, that's the only way out of this hell that we've created for ourselves in this global social media shit show is that what Vlad just said. That's what makes me happy. Like, make a list of what makes you happy and do that. And being a part of a community is one of the best things you can do for your brain. Okay, what do we got here? Hey, Owen. This is from Anthony. Hey, Owen. Big fan. What is this? Is this... been a big fan. Heard of you through Pandora and looked to see if you were on the podcast, on any podcast. Luckily for me, I stumbled on your podcast and have been hooked ever since. I really like your perspective on things, so I'd like to hear your take on dudes from different states and countries bash each other respectfully, disrespectfully. It's very interesting to me. So let me know what you think. I have two links below for you to watch if you have the time. Also, congratulations on being a new dad soon. I just had a daughter last October, so I know how excited you must feel. Thanks for your time. Okay, let's check it out. Which one should we look at? Well, maybe I should just do it in my own time, and then I'll write to you. I'll write to you, Anthony. I'll let you know what you think. But I used to be a heckler at a Renaissance fair. I love battles. Respectful battling is very necessary for the mental health of a nation. Being able to make fun of each other, very important, guys. Very important. If not, if you can't like have a fist fight in the yard, it starts building and building and building. And before you know it, you're an Uber driver just shooting people in the face. What's this one? Okay. Some Chris. Unfortunately, we live in a world where people on social media disagree with an opinion and feel the need to attack and essentially try and fuck up someone's life career. Where I think you fucked up, I know what he's referring to. Where I think you fucked up on was assuming that everyone is as educated as you are or even watched your YouTube video in regards to the word cunt. You took an unfortunate Twitter beating because there was no context and it's not made for your discussion. You didn't lose fans, that's for sure. Just keep doing what you're doing. I can't wait to see, wait to you discuss this on the podcast. That's in reference to an unfortunate line of Twitter things that happened after the Beyonce halftime show, which, you know, disgusted me kind of. I don't like racial pageantry. As a World War II history major and a big fan of human nature discussion, holding your fist in the air doesn't usually unify people, especially when you don't have a specific gripe. You can't just say, be better to us. It just doesn't work like that. That being said, I misstepped a lot. I shouldn't have called Beyonce a cunt because, you know, some people take way more offense to that word than others. I happen to not take any offense to that word. I think it's a very precise word, and it's a perfect word to use in the right situation. I think that, yeah, and it's not a gendered word. You can call a man a cunt just like you can call a man a dick or a woman a dick. Yeah, I just don't. I don't like it at all. And I don't like anytime I'm not allowed to criticize someone, it's like that Voltaire quote, you know who oppresses you by who you're not allowed to criticize. Whenever I feel a pushback, I got it also from Barbara Streisand fans. Whenever you feel that pushback or that intolerance where that's like you cannot have an opinion about the queen bee, I did not get into comedy to not push that. That's where that's when you feel that weakness, because it means you're onto something. It means like something's behind this door where it's like whatever you're saying is probably a little more valid than people want to admit. And yes, there is an old Black Panthers party that's different than the new Black Panthers party. And the new one are a bunch of racist assholes that are very comparable to the KKK. The old one was a response to horrible civil unrest and injustice in America. And they might have done some messed up shit, but at least it was a by any means necessary situation. So, yeah, in the future, I'm just not going to make fun of Beyonce because I just truly don't have the time. I mean, I don't always get to write back to people on that, like, write me these beautiful letters. Like, the last thing I want to do is argue with people on Twitter that say I need to get edumacated. I mean, it's so deeply stupid. Hang on, let me check out this other account. I have like, it's just so deep. Like, my wife and I were trying to work on new terms. Like, cause we think that a lot of things in life are because words are changing, like the meaning of a word. And like, for example, fact right now does not mean what it meant 10 years ago. Like, a fact is just whatever you say it is now. It's almost like a fiction. It's like switching roles. Ignorant just means that someone doesn't agree with you. If someone's like, you're ignorant, basically they're just saying, I have a different opinion. Because, not trying to be an asshole here, but the last thing I am is ignorant. I'm ignorant to certain things. Japanese language, sports, certain sports I know nothing about. But I'm not going to speak on something that I don't know anything about. I've probably read books on the topic I'm discussing, and I don't think very many people do that. And those are the people that loudly tell you you need to be edumacated. All right, let me see. Okay, it's from Devin. Hey, Owen, I love what you're doing on the podcast. I've been meaning to write for a little while, but been putting it off. I got completely caught up with the shows. Congrats on getting married and the baby. You see, this is what I'm talking about. People care about community. They care about family. That's what they care about. You see, everyone, no one's telling me congrats on some like career thing. Congrats on selling something out. Congrats on doing this show. They're saying congrats on my wife and my baby. And it's authentic and it's from everyone. And that's amazing to me. Okay, back to the letter. So many cool life events have been happening to you just in the span of Why Didn't They Laugh's existence. That's cool. That's cool that you said that. Because it's like, I do feel like I make this podcast personal, and I'm glad that we all get to go on a journey together. I originally started following you back in the MySpace days. It still chuckles at ways to get off the phone quickly bit. What time is it? 11:30. Quick. Yeah, it's a classic. MySpace disappeared, and years later, I got a suggestion to follow you on Twitter. I finally caved in to your tweets and decided to start listening to the podcast. It was a small choice, but ended up being a really good one. Before college, I used to read all the time, but stopped due to all of the other mandatory reading and homework. I never got back into it since graduating, but you've turned me on to all kinds of great books and podcasts to listen to that make running, driving, and doing menial tasks at work a lot more interesting and fruitful. I think your Facebook algorithm rants are hilarious. My social media experience is a little bit bipolar, though. I grew up in a small eastern Kentucky town that is aggressively religious and right-wing, so my Facebook is full of Breitbart, Fox, and Obama conspiracies. I've been leaning a lot further to the left since leaving my hometown and follow more liberal people and news outlets on Twitter. I'm in the perfect spot to see both of the rage machines in action. And from that, I can start to figure out what exactly is going on in, with major world events and Beyonce performances. I'd love to hear another episode with your mom or dad soon. They seem like amazing people, and I could easily sit down to talk to them for hours. Keep up the great work on the show. I don't always agree with you 100%, but you are always genuine and bring thoughtful perspectives to the issues discussed on your show. Best of luck to you and Amy as the due date approaches. Stay hydrated. Devin Davison. P.S. I'm really terrible at subject lines and needed to work that question in somewhere because I can't remember which episode you talked about the shoe company and wanted to go check it out. The title is, what brand of shoe running shoes did you recommend on the show? Oh, maybe it was Brooks. I like Brooks. That's like a shoe company that, they're pretty expensive though, but they're dope. They don't spend any money on advertising. They just spend it on the shoes. This email was awesome because it's what I'm yearning for. Is I don't agree with you all the time, but you're genuine. That's perfect. Why can't we all be like that? I have friends that some of their views are completely opposite of mine, and I love them. They're like my family. I think that the more quote unquote diverse America gets, the more we have to start being okay with other ways of thinking, or else it's just going to be this constant and unnecessary conflict. And I'm glad that you're reading again, Devin, because the problem with all of us is when people make something mandatory, they no longer like to do that thing. Whether it's like telling your wife she has to blow you every morning, or like your teacher telling you you have to read a book. It's like that makes the person not want to do it. Just because you're told you have to, and it'll take the fun out of it. Like reading a book or sucking my cock is an honor. Yeah, it's like that's why like humans aren't as motivated by if-then situations as they are intrinsic. Like, who am I? What's my purpose? What do I love? And I can't tell you how much my life has improved since I've gotten into more podcasts and listening to books and reading books and working on myself and trying to be a happy person and just trying to be better to my wife. I mean, I used to be a horrible boyfriend to her back in the day, just a piece of shit. And it wasn't because I wanted to hurt her or I wanted to hurt anyone or I wanted to be something. It was, I had no real idea of how to do that, how to be in a loving, long-term relationship. And I putting in the work to find that and trying to understand myself and having an honest relationship with her is the best thing that's ever happened to me. It's just been like, 'cause now I look forward to coming home. I look forward to doing things with her and spending time with her. And we text all the time. We talk every night after I do a show. It's like when I'm out of town, when I'm home, it's like, it's a very romantic relationship. And it didn't used to be like that. We're always very attracted to each other. And we always laughed a lot at the same sense of humor, and she's really just a fascinating person. We've always like liked each other, but we also kind of hated each other. And I saw her as a fucking weight. She was pulling me back, and she saw me as an asshole that would, you know, lie and make her feel terrible because of my personal desires and my like selfishness, that I would just do what I wanted. And I'm so glad that's over. I almost like, I've had like nightmares about that time in my life where it's like, I can't imagine if I, like one time Benny ran into the middle of Sunset Boulevard when I first got him, because he, his head popped out of the collar. Now he wears a harness because he has kind of a small head and a big neck. And he ran to the middle of Sunset Boulevard and laid on his back because he was scared of the sound of a giant fan that was in front of Guitar Center. And Sunset Boulevard during the day is one of the most busy streets in America, okay? He just, out of fear, runs. Oh my God, it's hard for me to even think about this. He runs to the middle of the street. I just go, Benny! And he lies on his back looking at me for approval. His cars are just flying down the street. So I don't think, imagine if he gets hit by a car looking at me with eyes like, did I do good? I mean, so I run out in the street. Cars slam on the brakes. I literally am just pouring sweat. And I grab him and I just started crying. And I just ran off the road and I'm like, I could have just lost you. I will never not let you wear a harness again. And that, I wake up sometimes panicked about that scene. Just, it's that moment when he laid on his back and he looked at me and his tail, little tiny wag, like, don't be mad, I'll be good, because I yelled his name. He had no idea what cars were. I think that way about Amy and I sometimes. I'm like, I was Benny running into a street, not understanding that I was about to lose something. Like, Benny would have lost his life. I would have lost my family. And just to think that I was that close, because we broke up a few times, like in the beginning, like we were crazy. And to think that I almost couldn't have her and have the child we're about to have and the life that we have is terrifying. So I don't know what my original point was. Whew, God, Benny. Right now he's sitting at my feet, 11 years old. Such a good dog. Oh, man. All right, cool. I'm gonna start wrapping this up. So I'm doing South by Southwest in Austin. I'm doing a show on Tuesday there. It's a Why Don't They Laugh show. My podcast station is doing, it's going to be me and Eliza Schlesinger and Bert Kreischer. It's going to be awesome. So we're going to do that. And then I'm doing an Old Spice commercial type thing in South by Southwest, which is going to be really fun. I can't wait to work with my friend Jordy again in Comedy Central. And then I'm off the road for a while because my kid is coming. He's coming. My next week is going to be in Cleveland, unless Amy goes into labor a week and a half or 2 weeks late, because then I'm going to bail on Cleveland. If that's the case, I'll have to. I'm not missing my kid. But the Cleveland Improv in April, and then I'm doing the Chicago Improv also at some point in April. I can't remember the exact week, but if you just go to the website. And also, thank you, by the way, for the people that have given me positive reviews on iTunes. Can't tell you how important that is. And leave a couple this week, and I'll read them next week, because that's what that matters. That's the algorithm stuff. And it makes people trust listening to the podcast. I mean, that's what I do. Like, when I'm looking at a new podcast, I got to recommend a couple other podcasts. I just got into a couple that are pretty sweet. Oh, if you want something that isn't heavy, which is what I kind of look for a lot these days, which is like, I don't want to hear people complain an entire podcast. Myths and Legends podcast. It's like this dude just breaks down, whether it's King Arthur or Hercules or Merlin or the Little Mermaid or it's all these cool stories. And he doesn't read it as professorial as, like, you'll remember if you ever took a class in myths or stories, you know, there's so much dissection. He reads it almost like he's talking about friends that are just like hanging out. So I enjoyed that one today. I listened to a bunch of episodes. I flew back from Tampa today. Tampa was a wild weekend. I will have clips to analyze for my Friday episode from Tampa. There's some real, real interesting stuff went down. Thursday was great because I think a lot of my fans came Thursday, so the crowd was very, like, pro me. Friday, first show, a little drunk, a little rowdy. I had to whip them a little bit. At one point, I did tell them they were kind of stupid, but then I apologized. Friday, second show was one of the craziest shows I've ever had, ever. Turns out there was a couple having sex in the balcony. There was several drunk women that were just screaming at the top of their lungs randomly. It was bananas. It was truly, it was just a Northern Florida experience. Saturday, a blast. Those are two of my favorite shows I've done in a while. Both Saturday shows, the crowds were so great. That's the thing about Florida. It's like some of the coolest people ever live there. Some of the best comedy fans live there. And then also literally the craziest humans that you've ever met also live there. And then Sunday, I did one of my Sunday, like typically on Sunday is when I kind of go off the rails a little and try new stuff. And I did a bunch of new stuff on Sunday that the crowd responded well to. It definitely works in progress, but that was great. That was super fun. I did a lot of jokes about this whole concept of racism in America because I instinctively want to talk about it. Professionally, do I want to just talk about dogs and traffic and just kill every show? Sure. But I have so much material on relationships because that was a real issue in my life for a while. It was like a code I couldn't crack. I couldn't understand where all the rage was coming from. And I feel that way instinctively right now about the over-tribalization of America. The over, like, this is us and them. And within groups, they're splitting up. And within those groups, they're splitting up. And it's becoming to a point, there's a fever pitch where people don't even want you to bring it up. And that's when I come in. Because that's what you have to do as a comedian, is, like, relieve their tension. I'm not there to try and change the world. I'm not there to tell someone how to live or what the experiences are in their lives. I'm there to take away pressure off their shoulders in the form of laughter. Because laughter lets people say, we're all in this thing together. No one here gets out alive, guys. There's no Oscars when you're dead. So just like, my mom had a very close friend, Bunny Dimmel, great woman, died. Battled with weight, battled with stress. She would be the type who would have her Twitter open on her lap for hours and hours, just can't believe these goddamn Republicans. You know, they just so much tension and pressure and she wants justice, just this social justice. And she died young. She's like 50, dead. And that's from stress. So I recommend keeping your passion, but don't sacrifice what matters. And that's the fact that people are writing me that I have a wife and I'm about to have a baby. I have three dogs and none of them got hit by that car. Healthy, hydrated, and I'm alive. And so are you. If you're listening to this right now, you're still alive. And you may be in a position where you don't feel very alive, but you are. And you will continue to be alive. Until you're not. And that's fine. As long as we connect to ourself and the earth. I'll read more of my mom's book and other podcasts. I just thought I'd give you guys a taste. It's called Called to Healing, Reflections of the Power of Earth Stories and Women's Lives. So tweet me. I love getting your tweets. Hashtag WDTL. Why didn't they laugh? Yeah, hashtag WDTL. If you have any questions or ideas or comments about the podcast, just do that hashtag because I'm starting to understand the value of hashtags. I truly don't understand this shit, guys. when you do a hashtag, I can like click on it and then scroll through and see what everyone thinks about one thing. And I get that now. I used to think hashtags were like a joke, where it was like, I love you, hashtag, no I don't. Like I thought it was a way to be passive aggressive. I didn't understand how it all works. So hashtag me, Facebook me. I love you all. And thank you for listening to another episode of Why Didn't They Laugh with Oven Benjamin.